You are listening to local and regional news produced by KMUN with help from our news partners. I'm Skylar Butenchin.
It's Wednesday, December 10th. Scam emails that use public information to try to trick their targets into sending money have been making the rounds for a while, but recently some claim to come from North Coast cities and are targeting permit applicants, prompting officials to issue warnings. KMUN's Katie Frankowitz reports.
At the start of December, the Astoria City Council was due to interview possible candidates to fill a vacant seat on the council. One of those candidates received an email. It was from the City of Astoria Planning and Zoning Commission, thanking the candidate for his interest in participating in public service and local government leadership, and then notifying him that he might be responsible for administrative and application-related fees. The email even warned against sending financial information or wire transfers or payments to any unofficial addresses or third-party sources. In November, a contractor doing work for Fort George Brewery had received an email claiming to be from the City of Astoria with an invoice that referenced a real application the brewery has in front of the city. The email was also signed with the name of an actual City of Astoria employee. In Seaside, similar scam emails have popped up several times this year, targeting permit applicants. The emails attach fake invoices and request wire transfers of money. The fake invoices use the city's branding, says Joshua Heineman, a spokesperson for the City of Seaside.
Yeah, listen, these are very sophisticated, and they're using a bunch of public information that just gets, by the nature of city business, gets publicized, and then they use it. So I think for me the biggest tell is that they often ask you to do something like wire money, which is not something the city's ever going to ask you to do.
It's not a new con, but it's something Heineman doesn't think will slow down anytime soon. He hasn't heard of anyone falling for the scams yet, but says that sometimes people feel embarrassed when they've been duped and don't report it. Heineman says that if you receive a suspicious email claiming to be from a city department and requesting payment of fees, you should call the publicly available number for City Hall or the specific department referenced and double-check the information. I'm Katie Frankowitz reporting.
Long Beach, Washington is the epicenter of Pacific County's summer tourism economy. According to recent data from the Washington State Department of Revenue, sales tax revenue in Long Beach was down about 2% this July, August, and September compared to the same three-month period in 2024. The data from the state also shows lodging tax collections this summer were down more than 4% year over year in Long Beach. But further south on the peninsula, Ilwaco saw strong gains in its sales tax collections this summer, finishing up nearly 20% compared to last year. Lodging tax revenue in Ilwaco came in about 1.4% lower than the previous summer. For unincorporated Pacific County, which includes communities like Seaview, Ocean Park, Chinook, and Nacelle, sales tax revenue was up 5.7% year-over-year, but lodging tax collections were down 7%. Looking at the overall numbers, Long Beach City Administrator David Glasson said he considered it a decent year. When asked about the discrepancy between the direction of the city's sales and lodging tax revenues, Glasson said that with inflation up, people are paying more for everything, which generates more sales tax. This story comes to us through a news partnership with the Chinook Observer, online at chinookobserver.com. Tillamook County had a strong financial start to its current fiscal year. That's according to a quarterly budget update from Deborah Jacob of the Tillamook County Treasurer's Office. Jacob told county commissioners at a recent meeting that the favorable performance for the first quarter compared to past years was largely due to timber revenues from state forests coming in more than $800,000 higher than in the previous fiscal year. Other drivers of the better-than-projected performance included specific transfers from the Parks Department and revenue stabilization funds to the county's general fund. Jacob said that the treasurer's office was still projecting a $2 to $3 million funding gap annually in the coming years. Tillamook County commissioners have been working on a list of revenue-generating and cost-cutting measures for the future. Some of those ideas include instituting a utility fee on electric bills, a systems development charge, a vacant housing fee, and seeking a local option levy in support of the sheriff's office. This story comes to us through a news partnership with the Tillamook Headlight Herald. Read more online at tillamookheadlightherald.com. A lithium mining exploration project in southeast Oregon's Malheur County got federal approval on Monday. Cassandra Profita with OPB reports.
Australia-based mining company Jindalee Resources has been exploring the idea of developing a lithium mine for years. Now it has the approval to take the first step in that direction by drilling about 160 exploratory holes on federal land near the Nevada state line. The area hosts one of the world's largest deposits of lithium, a valuable metal in batteries. Skylar Vold with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife says it's also prime sage-grouse habitat. The birds have multiple mating sites in the project area.
And if a giant open pit mine were to go in here, it would not be good for these populations of sage-grouse, let alone any other species.
The federal approval restricts mining activity during sage-grouse mating season to protect the birds. I'm Cassandra Profita, reporting.
The federal government has denied a petition to list two populations of Chinook salmon as endangered. A group of nonprofits sought the protections for salmon along the Oregon coast down into Northern California. Jeff Miller with the Center for Biological Diversity says they only wanted protections for the spring run salmon, but the National Marine Fisheries Service currently lumps these spring and fall run salmon together.
We really want the protections to apply to the fish that need them the most, which is the spring run, and we can't do that in the way the feds currently manage salmon populations.
The Fisheries Service says that the spring run salmon, which typically will travel further upstream to spawn, aren't distinct enough from the fall run salmon to be considered separately. Agency staff acknowledged an increased threat to spring run salmon because of rising stream temperatures and habitat loss. But the stronger fall-run population outweighed the need to protect the salmon overall. The drier climate is causing wildfires to become more intense and destructive. In their wake, reforestation is a growing industry. Roy-based Silva Seed, southeast of Olympia, plays a key role. The company collects, cleans, catalogs, and preserves seeds. KNKX environment reporter Bellamy Palethorpe has the story.
Inside a warehouse built in the 1940s, Silvaseed General Manager Kia Woodruff flips the switch to fire up a huge old kiln. Inside are long racks filled with green cones collected from western forests that will slowly open in the heat. Woodruff says most species need it to reach about 100 degrees Fahrenheit.
That's about the temperature that encourages them to open their scales. Like, think of it as a hot summer day.
After the seed is extracted and funneled into burlap sacks, it goes next door, where more machinery shakes the seed and the chaff. At every step of the way, as the seed gets refined and purified, the bags are meticulously labeled and tracked. Seed from sugar pines, Pacific silver firs, Doug firs, noble firs, and western larch surround us, each bag with precise information on the lot number, elevation, and zone it came from.
We need to know where the seed came from, otherwise it has very little value for reforestation.
She says the unique genetics of each tree make it suitable for the conditions where it will be planted. If it's the wrong tree, it might start to grow too early and get damaged by frost or heat. The seeds are tested and x-rayed in a lab for moisture and purity before they're finally stored in a freezer.
The most valuable structure.
Standing between the rows of boxes in the company's chili seed bank, Woodruff says this vault holds seeds going back to the 1960s. She says Silvaseed is preserving unique genetics that are now at risk of loss.
Because, again, as climate change continues, could cause devastation in our forests, whether it's from fires or whether it's from insect outbreaks. It's really important that we maintain this resource, and so I'm grateful every time I'm in this freezer.
And she says the company's recent acquisition by Seattle-based Mast Reforestation is allowing it to be part of a bigger solution. I'm Bellamy Palethorpe reporting.
St. Michelle Wine Estates has been purchased by the Wyckoff family. The Wyckoffs own a variety of agricultural businesses across Washington state. St. Michelle is Washington's largest winery. NWPB senior correspondent Anna King has the details.
St. Michelle has gone through several ownership changes over the last several years. Most recently, it's been owned by Sycamore Partners, a private equity firm based in New York. St. Michelle's portfolio comes with some prime properties like Cold Creek Vineyard near Hanford. That's one of the largest vineyards in the state. There's also the nearly 600-acre Canoe Ridge Estate and the massive Columbia Crest Winery and vineyards in the Horsehaven Hills. St. Michelle has roots in Washington back to 1933. I'm Anna King.
Tacoma leaders are considering rolling back eviction bans in response to claims that renters in the city are refusing to pay rent. These safeguards prevent property owners from removing tenants during the winter and, if they have a child, during the school year. Landlords say they need more freedom to evict people who are causing problems. However, renter advocates believe officials need to slow down before they change these protections. KNKX reporter Mitch Borden takes us to Tacoma to learn more about how low-income housing is being impacted by these eviction bans.
At the Dorothy Height Apartments in Tacoma, Miriam Barnett is excited to show off a two-bedroom unit.
There's lots of outlets. Notice all the outlets. So dishwashers, lots of cabinet space, full-size oven.
We visited the apartments earlier this year while she was serving as interim CEO of the YWCA of Pierce County. The nonprofit owns the building, and Barnett was a driving force in opening the affordable housing complex.
We have, in this unit, two very nice bedrooms with nice closets. Lots of windows, really bright rooms.
It provides low-income housing for people dealing with homelessness and domestic violence. It's decorated with tile mosaics, it has a playground for kids, and residents have a rooftop view of Commencement Bay.
So my goal is that when people unlock the door, it's the most beautiful place they've ever lived. Because to me, that's how you serve people who don't have the privileges that you have. You provide them with everything that you would want for your family.
But as dedicated as the YWCA is to providing affordable housing, it's faced major issues since 2023 when a voter initiative created the Landlord Fairness Code. The law established a number of sweeping renter protections. A main feature of the policy bars all landlords from evicting people during cold weather months. And if there's a child in a household, it prohibits them from being evicted during the school year.
For us, and I think probably for other affordable housing providers, the unintended consequence of that is people quit paying rent.
Since these protections were established, property owners across the city have reported an increase in tenants not paying rent. In response, the YWCA joined with the Tacoma Housing Authority and other affordable housing providers in calling on city leaders to exempt them from the eviction restrictions. They say the loss of rent is so extreme, it's jeopardizing their ability to maintain operations and build more low-income housing. Barnett says if they can't evict problem tenants, people who need the housing and are able to pay rent can't access it.
We can't maintain housing if we don't have the rent. It's not free housing. So that has made it very, very, very difficult. If we had known this was coming down the pike, we wouldn't have built the housing.
There are also concerns the tenant protections could make it harder to find rental housing across the board. A recent survey of more than 160 landlords, including private property owners, found that the majority are planning to own or operate less rental properties, at least in part because of the Landlord Fairness Code. Tacoma City Council member Sarah Rumbaugh is now spearheading an effort to change the policy.
I am concerned that we have a community that is forgetting about accountability. And I hate to use that word, but I don't want children growing up and thinking you don't have to pay your rent.
Currently, the Tacoma City Council is considering a number of proposals, including exempting nonprofit affordable housing providers from the eviction bans and limiting the cold weather eviction protections to only apply to low and middle income households. Rumbaugh is looking to finalize changes to the code before the end of the year because she doesn't want affordable housing providers to have to wait any longer.
I want us to do something to help our low-income housing providers stay in business, be able to continue to rent to people who are at the highest risk renters, and want to create more low-income housing.
Tyron Moore says the Landlord Fairness Code helps people stay off the street. He's the co-director of the tenant advocacy group Tacoma for All, which led the effort to create the policy.
Yes, I'm sure our tenant protections hurt the bottom line of landlords. But in the end, you know, when we're talking about very vulnerable sections of our population living paycheck to paycheck, folks facing evictions, yeah, I'm sorry, I'm going to take the sides of tenants.
Moore acknowledges nonprofits that provide housing may need some flexibility to remove people who are causing problems. Still, he says these protections can help prevent homelessness, but more needs to be done.
We need massively greater numbers of affordable housing, of vouchers, of subsidies, but that's not immediately on offer. And so, you know, we're left with sort of a hard set of choices when you reduce the question to, like, how strong of eviction protections should the city of Tacoma have?
Moore says council members Rumbaugh and her allies are moving too fast and need to hear more from local renters, like Frances Faye Oak.
Hi there.
Hi.
How's it going?
Nice to meet you, Frances Faye.
Yeah, nice to meet you too.
Recently, I met her at her market rate apartment building. Walking in, you can tell it's old and has some issues.
I like the carpet.
Yeah, it's got a little bit of vintage quality to it.
Totally.
So do the holes in the wall.
That too.
She lives in a studio with her daughter and two cats. Oak says ever since voters approved the Landlord Fairness Code, it's given her and her neighbors some peace of mind.
A lot of people are afraid of their landlords. They're afraid of being kicked out of their homes. They're afraid of having to go to the hospital and needing to get surgery and not being able to work for a couple months and not being able to pay rent.
She says the eviction protections especially gave families like hers that have kids a fighting chance.
The no evictions in the winter is huge, you know, especially as someone with a child, that like, that's not going to happen to me when she's in the midst of school, and like, our lives aren't going to be upturned like that.
Oak doesn't live in affordable housing, but she doesn't understand why people who do should receive fewer protections.
Should they be easier to evict than me? No, I don't think so. At the very base level, these rights should be for all renters.
But for groups like the YWCA that offer low-income housing, Miriam Barnett says there needs to be some sort of balance.
You can't just let things go on that are going to harm the agency and create a situation that might harm other people down the road, because those units might not be available if we can't figure this out.
The Tacoma City Council is now finalizing proposed amendments to the Landlord Fairness Code and could hold a final vote at the council's next meeting. I'm Mitch Borden, reporting.
Local and regional news on KMUN is brought to you by our news partners and the KMUN news team. That includes me, host and producer Skylar Butenchen, news intern Sylvia Thorpe, and news director Katie Frankowitz. Our news broadcasts air Monday through Thursday, beginning at 7:59 in the morning and 4:59 in the evening. Thanks for listening.